What's happening, y'all? This is Todd Wilson with another episode of Elevate Your Game. Today, we have husband, father, head coach of Notre Dame boys basketball, former Division I player, former pro as well, right?
Not quite.
Okay.
Almost.
He plays like a pro, man. He can hoop. All right. So, Mr. Matt Sargent, man. Welcome to having you.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Been a long time coming. I've been wanting you on the show for a long time, and just life happens, but I'm glad to have you here.
I appreciate it. My mom's a big fan of your podcast.
She's crazy, man.
Yeah.
Your mom.
My mom's just steeped in the basketball world. She's more steeped than I am. I don't have social media. She's the one that like sends me all the posts all the time.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Shout out moms. I appreciate it. We got them on here for you. Love it. We love to start the show off with the Wall of Hoop movies, which is not set up in this studio presently, but if you can think of all the hoop movies in the world, what's your favorite?
I think it's sort of like a time frame thing with me. So like I pretty much grew up in the 90s, and so I remember when I was 8 years old, we won a championship, because my birthday's in March, and we had choice between seeing one of two movies, Ace Ventura or Blue Chips. And I was like, well, that one's the basketball movie, so let's go see that. And so we went to see Blue Chips.
At 8 years old?
Yeah.
Crazy.
Well, and like that movie holds up. I mean, in the new NIL era, it's like we're moving in a different space, but like 3 years ago, if you watch Blue Chips, like it is way ahead of its time. But I guarantee in the moment, like at all over my head, I was just like, oh, Shaq and Penny, they're dunking. Right. Great. So I think Blue Chips for me is still like my favorite basketball movie. Most rewatchable basketball movie.
No, amazing. It's an amazing movie. Like you said, it gives insight to what it is today and what people are actually allowed to do with this NIL stuff. Yes. I had a call yesterday. There's a freshman who has an NIL deal to get free training for his whole high school career.
Okay.
But like...
Whatever works.
Yeah, so hey, more power to you. That's awesome. Yeah. But crazy stuff. So when did you fall in love with basketball?
Probably like implicitly. My dad had a Sunday morning pickup game that he played in. And the way he describes it, all the guys in the pickup game brought all their children so that, you know, the wives could have a Sunday morning to themselves. Yeah. So he would just put me off to the side as young as like 2 years old. And so I was in the gym at two, just off to the side playing with a bunch of kids while my dad's playing pickup. So I think I kind of like absorbed some stuff then. I didn't start like shooting hoop until I was like six. And then I just fell in love with putting the ball in the basket. So from that point on, I didn't really do anything else.
Man. And you didn't play any other sports?
Nope. I think I tried baseball twice and was just... emotional about why I had to be playing baseball and I wasn't playing basketball.
Same.
Like, we want you to do other stuff. I was like, I don't want to be doing other stuff. Just put me on a basketball team. And so I didn't ever play football or soccer, none of that. Just did two seasons of baseball and then basketball was it.
And where'd you grow up?
Grew up in La Cañada, suburb outside of Pasadena. And then I was there until about freshman year. And then we moved to Huntington Beach for my last 3 years of high school.
Nice. Okay. So Cali guy.
Cali guy.
All the way. Warmers. Awesome. And then so coming up, did your dad teach you was he your trainer? I know we didn't have trainers back then. Like, how did you develop your skills as a young kid?
So one is a lot of time in the backyard by myself, but then my youth coach from 6 to 13 was John Wooden's grandson-in-law. And so he basically, we had like a YMCA league for the 6 and 7 year olds, and his son was my age. So he coached against me and then wanted to start his own team. And so he basically picked like the 8 best players and just said, I'm gonna try and keep these kids together. I'm gonna teach them the pyramid of success. I'm gonna run UCLA John Wooden practices, and we're just gonna develop them. So that's where I got most of my sort of team philosophy development. And then from the skill standpoint, around the age of 10, I met a guy named Eric Cooper, who started my individual training. And then around the age of 11 or 12, I met a guy named Chris Small, who trained me up until when I left for Huntington Beach. And then when I was in Huntington, I basically just trained myself.
Wow. Just picked it all up.
Well,
from
I had done so much training, and I knew enough and I was self-motivated that I just had my coach, you know, find time to get me in the gym. And I would get me and a couple teammates, whoever wanted to condition and run a lot. We train ourselves. It was a different era.
Yeah. Why was there the move to Huntington?
I went to a school called Pasadena Polytechnic, which is probably the number one academic school in the state. And as a freshman, I played varsity, averaged like 18 a game, and I just wanted a different challenge. I kind of saw what the future was going to be for me. I was already getting double teamed as a freshman. I knew it was only going to get worse, and I just wanted to stretch myself a little bit and compete with better players in practice and against better players in the games. And so it was really between Bishop Montgomery, Ocean View, and Modern Day. And when I met Coach Harris at Ocean View, we just clicked. And I was like, I just want to play for that guy. And my youth coach, they had moved to Huntington 3 years prior.
Oh, wow.
And so my buddy John, his son, who I'd been playing with for, you know, 7, 8 years, was already there. So I wanted to play with him. I wanted to get coached by Coach Harris. And I was blessed to have that opportunity.
And your parents just got up and moved?
Yep.
For basketball?
I don't talk about this much. I was a pretty highly regarded player coming up. So, mm-hmm. I received my first college letter when I was in the 8th grade. I mean, I was very much on track to be a Division I player. My parents were phenomenally supportive. I mean, traveling to all these tournaments and, you know, obviously, like, giving the opportunity to train. And so they want to support my dreams, and they saw that it was a reality. I think, obviously, if it wasn't going to be true, then maybe they wouldn't have. I was on that pace, and so they wanted to support me. And so my dad, bless his heart, incredible man for lots of reasons, but he commuted from Huntington to Pasadena and back all 3 years of high school.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he actually bought the first version of a natural gas vehicle so he could go in the carpool lane by himself. It was this tiny little Honda Civic.
Oh, yeah, I remember that thing with a little sticker on the side.
Sticker on the side. So he's the first person I ever saw that didn't even know it existed, but he had to problem solve how to not make it a 5-hour commute, whittle it down to a 2-hour commute.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And you were in the car with him the whole time?
No.
You moved. Yeah, oh, but he would come back for work.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, because he was working in Pasadena.
That's amazing. The things that parents do for their kids, for this game, is amazing. And I don't think parents get enough credit.
I have incredibly supportive parents. Both my sister and myself both had phenomenal experiences with my parents supporting our dreams.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. And do you see a difference now as a coach when the way that parents support their kids' dreams, right? You had some trajectory of being this great player and your parents gave you the resources, but did they coddle you and hold your hand like some of these parents do now? What was the difference?
No, and again, there's a range of parent behavior, right? Some coddle, some don't. But for me personally, I was very self-motivated. There was nothing for my parents that were like, you have to go train, you have to go do this. I wanted to do it. So I think because of that, because I was so self-motivated from such a young age, it makes it easier on them to support me when I'm trying to do something, because they know that when we move, I'm gonna put 110% effort into it. In fact, there was one, I remember this, my mom very rarely got mad at me because I was pretty straight kid. But I remember we just moved to Huntington. It was my 5th or 6th Spanish assignment, and I was not a good Spanish student. I mean, I had a cumulative GPA in high school of 3.9, but I mean, I just could not learn Spanish.
That was the point one.
Which is ironic now because my twins are bilingual because my wife is fluent. But anyway, and I remember I gave very low effort on an assignment and got it back and I got a C. Mm. And my mom lit into me. She's like, your father's commuting 4 hours round trip and you're gonna put this kind of effort into an assignment. It wasn't even like a test. It was just like a homework assignment, and she just went at me. So I mean, that's the only thing that they really held my feet to the fire on was, you have to give full effort. We're sacrificing for you. You have these big dreams. If your effort doesn't match your dreams, then what are you doing and what are we doing? And so that was the only time, and it didn't happen often. I was pretty, like I said, I worked really hard. But there was no hand-holding or coddling. I will say they picked their spots with me. They knew how much time and effort I was spending with school and with basketball. So, there was no you gotta get a job. There was none of that sort of extra stuff. They knew how much time that I was spending.
Yeah.
But they didn't coddle me at all.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I think it's great to hear to have you were motivated to do this, so they supported you and not the other way around. I think today in today's culture, the parents are motivated and they're trying to push for their kid to be a certain level of player because they like the sport, not maybe love the sport. And being able to recognize that in your kids, what age do I stop pushing them for them to take over and now be their resource?
And I think one of the things I learned from my parents that I'm trying to do with my kids, because people always ask me all the time, you have a 5-year-old son, he's going to be a basketball player. I don't know. I want him to work hard and love whatever it is that he wants to be doing. And so that was the one thing that was consistent with my parents, that they just kind of demanded excellence and hard work. And I got to watch that with how my dad went about his life and how my mom went about her life. My mom gave us, she only worked for 3 or 4 years in my childhood. She was mostly with us, and just how seeing how hard she worked to take care of my sister and I. And then watching how much time and effort my dad spent in his work, I kind of knew what it looked like to have that level of care and that what it looked like to be excellent. And so, you know, that's all they really demanded. And if that meant I was a basketball player, fine. For my sister, it was her acting and it was her academics and eventually it was her writing. But it was just, whatever you're doing, like, be great.
Yeah.
That was it. And like, that should be, so that's what I'm trying to do with my son. Like, hey man, you know, he wants to be a basketball player, great. If he wants to be a painter, I don't really care. I want to demand excellence out of him from his effort and from the time he spends.
So you see your parents as an example and you've copied that behavior, right? What other things are you doing maybe even with your son now, maybe verbally or other types of communication to show him, hey, you got to put your hard work in and give that effort?
Yeah, I mean, my son in particular likes to push the boundaries of what he can and can't get away with. And so, you know, my twin girl's only two, so I don't know if it's a boy or girl thing. We'll see how their personality continues to develop.
They're worse, just so you know. I'm
sure they'll push the boundaries in their own way. But, you know, for Benny, like, he needs a firm hand. Like, he needs to be given really strict, hardcore boundaries. Apologies. Of sort of, you know, what he can and can't get away with and what is right and what is wrong. And he's always going to push, And what's funny is, I don't know if you have this experience, he does that with myself and my wife, but when he goes to school, or he goes
perfect
to
kid, and a little angel.
Yeah, they like, I think it's the hope of every parent that like we are the ones that see the worst of our kids.
Yes.
And just the whole world, they're sweet little angels who are listening. I hear all the time, like, but he's a great listener. He's so polite. Like, man, I'm happy you're experiencing that because I'm constantly having to negotiate or stop the negotiations in our household. But yeah, I mean, my parents always treated my sister and I like adults. They didn't talk to us like kids. I mean, we were, you know, always communicated with from a standpoint of, you know, how we're supposed to behave in a world where we need to be conscientious, appropriately agreeable. Sorry. Appropriately agreeable. And I just try to do that with my son as well.
Yeah, no, that's good. I like that. Communicate to them as they're adults. Like, I never did baby talk with my kids. My daughter is very well versed and she comprehends stuff on a different level than I think I did when I was a kid, for sure.
Yep.
My son, on the other hand, is different. But when he's in public, they call him Angel Baby. Like, literally, it doesn't matter. It does. Like, everybody calls him an Angel Baby. But with us, oh boy. We were up. He wakes up at 3 a.m. every day right now. We just moved to toddler bed. Wow. And he stays awake. So I've been up since 3 a.m. I'm going home and taking a nap for sure. But yes, yeah. I'm sure you went through with twins and handling that. I do want to talk about, we're going to hop around. We usually go a little chronological, but we're on this parenting topic, like the balance. You were in the middle of your season and you had twins.
Yeah.
And had a older son already. What is that balance like?
It was a pretty dark time. Like, I think if my wife were here, she'd probably say the same thing. First of all, if you don't have a supportive partner, it's like, for those that don't, I don't know how they do it, but like, like, my wife is, you know, such an incredible partner, so supportive. And, you know, we hold the line together with how we want to raise our kids, which is, again, we're both sort of lucky. That could have been not the case. You can always fall in love with someone. And then when it comes to parenting, you have different parenting styles or different parenting values. We luckily align and we parent similarly and we hold the line the same way. But yeah, man, like we just talked about last night, like that first year of our twins' life, I don't remember anything. It's pure, like, we were just in pure survival mode, just trying to get through it. Thankfully some people took pictures, so I know what happened. We could see it, but we were really just trying to get through it. You know, she was starting her own law firm at the same time because, you know, having two twins, she had to change jobs because in California it's expensive, they're trying to make more money. So it was a really, really, really intense time that we really only started to get out of really after the twins turned two.
Yeah.
Because then we could put them in actual daycare and have it be somewhat affordable. Right. But yeah, it was, people ask this question all the time. I feel like people that have one kid see people with two kids, how do you do it? And people have two kids, people with three kids, oh my God, how do you do it? And the answer is the same, like, you just do it.
Yeah, you figure it out.
There's just things that are in front of you and you just get it done. And if you have more kids, there's just more things, I guess, to do. But ultimately, we're all on the same path of like, there's just something to be done.
Yes.
And you do it. And you're not thinking twice about it. And you're doing it the best you possibly can.
You figure it out. You figure it out, man. No, congratulations on getting through that and, you know, continuing your career.
Yes.
And
yes.
Your wife getting opening the law firm, like all that good stuff. That's I think I stopped coaching when I had kids. I mean, I was an assistant at Heritage, and I literally am like, nope, I can't do this. I do not know how to balance this, and I had to take a step back, and I'm like, I won't return to coaching until my son is capable of managing his own life. My daughter pretty much has it. She's figured it out. Yeah. You know, boys take a little longer, and so until he's ready, I'm like, man, I don't know if I can step back on and actually coach because of the evening time that it takes out of your life. And so my hat's off to you.
I mean to be frank, like, kind of get into the Notre Dame thing real quick, like, you know, one of the reasons that I think we didn't make open last year was our strength of schedule. It wasn't as good as it had been in the previous 3 years. And that was, you know, my wife, after we won state, coming to me and being like, we barely made it this year. Like, you're staying close to home next year. We have more year of the Twins. Like, you're only playing games within a certain radius. So if you go look at our schedule, there's one common denominator, is that we didn't go anywhere.
Yes.
I played tournaments within 20 to 25 miles, with the exception of the Nike Extravaganza, which is on a weekend, so Caesar Fine Childcare. Right. And I'm like, I'm a father first. I got to take care of my family.
Newfound respect for you.
Huh?
I have newfound respect for you. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And no, so, you know, everybody, we question that as basketball people. Like, you're stacked. Why are you playing these local teams? But hey, family first, I'll always respect that.
And like, you know, I only shared it, in retrospect, I probably should have just shared it with the entire program, right?
Yeah.
Because like, I think they would have understood, but you know, it's hard to admit, like, hey, like, we're struggling and there's really no way for this to get done. But you know, I did, you know, because it was Mercy's senior year, and I did go to him and his dad, I was like, listen, like, we're not traveling. So if you guys, it's a senior year, if you wanna, national schedule, because that you want to transfer, like, I get it, but there's just no way I can do it. And luckily, they love the school and they love the program, so they stayed. But you know, and we're back to traveling this year. But it was just that 1 year, like, that's the sacrifice I had to make, because we traveled the first year of the Twins' life, and it was. I'm happy I'm still married. That's credit to my wife that I'm still married.
No, that's awesome, man. That's I love that, man. I think more coaches should take a note of that, because you see a lot of relationships when it comes to marriage and coaching takes over and basketball takes precedent, when the priority should always be family, because we're not only coaching these kids, we're mentoring them and being examples for them. And so if they see us putting the family first and doing those things, then hopefully they follow suit. Basketball is going to end one day. Yep. And so that's a hats off to you, man. That's awesome. So rolling into high school. Well, let's start this. When did you start the AAU scene? So you had early college interest, which means you were on the scene pretty early.
Yeah. I started playing AAU, ARC has that league, right?
Okay, yeah.
Rich has been doing that for 40 years. And so he puts his club team together. So around the age of almost 9-10, I was on club team. We won AAU Nationals. So that team had, I think, 8 guys that went on to play Division I.
Anybody we remember?
Yeah, sure. I know, Josh Shipp was on the team, played UCLA. Adrian Idark, Marcus Everett played football at UCLA. Brandon Rodman went to Alamany. I forget where he played afterwards. Obviously myself, Ed White, who ended up playing at Yale. I'm forgetting a couple. Robert Lewis played football in Washington.
Dang, stacked.
Vince Oliver, who played at UC Davis. I know I'm forgetting somebody. But yeah, we were, you know, and myself, you know, ended up playing at Princeton. So we were very talented. I think we didn't lose a game for 2 years. We eventually lost to Top Prospects Inc., who we got introduced to a young man by the name of Marcus Williams.
Oh,
and that was the first time I was like, "Oh, there's levels of this." Marcus was on a
different, right?
Just a different level than all of us.
Marcus, I just invited you to the show again today. Answer your text message, man. We need you here. That's amazing. Just at that age to be that competitive too. Before AAU is the beast that it is today, where you actually had to be good to be on an AAU team.
Well, it was interesting back, people don't believe me when I tell them. So back then, there was basically like 3 or 4 AAU teams. It was like ARC, SCA, Southern California All-Stars, Top Prospects Inc. And then, like, I remember, like, passing the Boys Club, like, had a really good team back then. I think that's it. And then eventually there was a Hoop Sessions, which I joined, that Harold Jones ran. But basically, like, the only tournaments we played were over holiday weekends, because that's when parents get the time off. And then we would play in these, like, Saturday leagues where we kind of just beat up on each other. So basically play one game a week.
Yep.
And then have a tournament, like, basically once a month, maybe once every 2 months.
Yep.
And that was it. And it put a really sense of urgency on, like, you know, we're playing you this one Saturday. We might not get you for another 4 or 5 Saturdays. It would be really intense games where like really, really mattered versus now it's so saturated because if I'm playing 5 games in a weekend, every other weekend, I don't think that level of urgency is really created.
No, not at all.
And by the way, we're never going back. So maybe make an argument to go back to
No, that. I'm trying to get it back. I've been talking to like some, you know, the US basketball development people, the NBPA development people, like they're really trying to figure out a way where it is 1 or 2 games a week. I think for the people who are serious about basketball, I think AAU is very recreational at this point because anybody can pop up with a team, right?
Yep.
And for the kids who are serious, to give them the information and the parents, like, hey, if you want a route to actually get to college or have an opportunity to go pro, this is what you really should be doing. And it's going to take a long time. I'm not saying it's going to happen overnight, but
yep.
I think there's enough people now in this space who understand that these 8 games a weekend are it's killing these kids.
Well, the conversations to have are with USA Basketball and with the NBA because, I mean, there is a model out there. Like, the Europeans have been doing this for decades now. So it would really be the NBA and USA, like, taking over youth sports and taking it away from sort of the commercialization and commodification that we're currently at right now. So as long as it's a business operating on its own, there's no incentive for it to change.
Exactly.
Because we're making a lot of money. But, the 5 games a weekend thing is just, it happens to my guys now. You know, we've been blessed the last few seasons to play into March. And once we're done playing, competing in the state tournament, like they basically have like these warm-up tournaments leading up into a live period. It's not even a live period anymore in April. And they'll come, and you know, we don't do anything in the spring, but we do lift. And all guys, coach, like I can't lift. I had 5 games this weekend. Like, what are you doing playing 5 games? Like, what are you doing?
For what?
And it's not their fault. You know,
right.
I'm asking that question rhetorically about just the system that we're in. You know, they have to play their own team. I get it.
There's a way to do it. BTI goes out there and they have practices. He has practices instead of playing in all those tournaments. They go and play in a tournament, but these club teams need to recognize what's best for these kids. Playing and throwing your team in a tournament to get chemistry, you get more chemistry in practice than you can in a game full of talented kids because they already know how to hoop.
Yep.
That's not it. You're rolling the ball out. Like, go and build chemistry. Teach them some more basketball. Like, give them some knowledge so they can actually get recruited and be effective once they get to college. What I'm seeing after Section 7 actually is my assessment is like kids are talented and skilled and college level talent, but they are going to struggle when they get to college when it comes to the IQ. Their IQ is off. And it's because, make sure I say this right. I'm not going to say it's because the coaches aren't teaching them either. They're not learning how to play the game the right way, which is going to prepare them to be impactful in college right away, you know, so.
Yeah, agree.
There you go. Thank you. I got it. All right, so high school.
Yeah.
What year did you graduate?
2004.
Okay, so we're the same age. Okay, I thought so. Okay, so you ever heard of Norco Tar Heels?
Of course,
yeah. That's what I played for back in the day. So cool. I'm sure we played in middle school sometime.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we were up here at ARC. Coach Patrick, what's Patrick's last name? He was an ARC coach. I played for him in like high school too, but. Back in the day, I grew up in the IE, so.
Yep. The IE wasn't until I got to high school where it was like Kool-Aid had his teams.
Yeah, IEBP and IEBP. All them, yeah. So, so we were, I got invited to it. This is why I do what I do. I got invited to an IEBP practice by Keith, who's the other person who operated it. And my mom was like, I'm not driving to Riverside for you. And I'm like, now I look back at it, I'm like, man, I missed the opportunity because my parents didn't know what that could have done for me at the time, which is fine. But high school. So you go to Oceanside.
Ocean View. Common mistake.
That's all right. Ocean View. What was your experience like in high school?
It was great. I loved it. It was everything I was looking for at a program. It's everything that I've tried to build as a program at Notre Dame. I mean, Coach Harris just like, you know, really knew how to create a program, not just teams that were successful, but a whole program where everyone felt like they were a part of something that was special, no matter what level they were at. All the coaches were in alignment with each other, and you know, I had great relationships with all my teammates. We didn't win a NCAA championship, got close a couple years, but you know, I had the gym space to train as much as I need to. Him and I had a really close relationship where he felt comfortable pushing me as much as I needed to be pushed, which I appreciated. And we were, very, very close until the day that he died. And, I cherish those. I'm still friends with, and even in our CF championship run, I had like five of my high school teammates just drive from all over Southern California to come watch us play.
Man,
so, I mean, it was everything I could have asked for in a high school experience. I try my best to recreate that with my current and former mm-hmm. players. Can't say I'm as good as Coach Harris was at it. But then again, by the time I met him, he had, he was like in his 32nd year.
So, oh, wow.
I have some time.
right. You grow into that. Yeah. What are those keys to build a program versus having a successful team?
Well, I think, so quick aside about Coach Harris. Coach Harris' JV coach was Gary McKnight. And I see Gary, like we always, every time I see him, we'll talk about Coach Harris. And, one of the things that Coach Harris was really about is, to really build a program, like the head coach needs to be in the gym. So anytime the gym was open, it was open pretty much all day, like Coach Harris was in there. Wow. He was the one picking up the trash. He was the one cleaning the floor. He was the one doing everything to make the gym a space that was open and welcoming to the whole community, kind of function as a community center. And we have a different gym situation at Notre Dame than he had there, so yeah. I can't like always be in the gym. We have one gym for a lot of sports.
Right.
But I try to at least mirror that commitment, because what that really is a commitment. The players, the yeah. families see how committed you are to your program. I try to mirror that as much as I possibly can. And then I think building a great program, not just great teams, really has to do with alignment of values. From head coach through to assistants to the JV, their assistants, and onward and forward, where, if not on the court, but specifically off the court, practices and values are instilled in the same way. So, Coach Harris, if you walked into a gym and you could, there's three courts and you have the varsity on one court, JV on another, and you have the freshman and sophomore team splitting it. And if you'd walk in the gym, you would see them doing the same drills, the same 4-on-4 shell done the same way, right? Mm-hmm. That's one part of it. And then Coach Harris had a number of values that are really important to him, that once they came to court after him, they lined center court with the values that are important to him. And so those values were being taught in the way that he wanted across all levels. He would bring in former players to coach his JV teams to create that continuity, or former players to be the freshman coach or to be assistants to create that continuity. When we had the sixth period basketball class in the springtime, we didn't practice because we weren't allowed to. So we played pickup, and he would always invite alumni to come and play. So, the varsity was playing against alumni basically every day. And most of those guys were college players.
Yeah.
And so that's how you sort of maintain a program, is allowing that kind of consistency and continuity in the messaging and the work ethic and the values to be consistent. And so I try to do that best I can,
yeah.
as good as he was. But that's, to me, that's what I try to aim for. And as one example, we have a gratitude practice that we do at the end of every, almost at the end of every single practice, some games. So my JV coach does the same thing. I've just hired a new freshman coach. He will then do the same thing. So that way, as they come up through the program, there's a familiarity across levels. The only thing that really changes is the intensity, the skill level, etc.
Right. No, that's awesome. I love that the progression of that, and that's how you build a company too, right?
Sure.
And so, experience that as core was a hobby at first, and then it's turned into a business, and now implementing all those things from from the students to the team to everybody, administration, making sure that we're all on the same page about what this is about, yeah. and the values of that. I have to ask, because people will question, is like, how do you do that? And you're accepting transfers all the time. How do you build that culture,
yeah.
if you're trying to build someone up from freshman, JV, varsity? You're a guy who accepts transfers. So how do you implement them into the culture and allow them to be a part of that?
Well, I think where I always start with this question is, again, Coach Harris, my mentor. Coach Harris was accepting transfers like in the 80s. And I was a transfer to him.
Yeah.
I transferred in my sophomore year. And I'll go back to Coach Harris in a second. One of the things, when I remember I interviewed at Notre Dame, I was coming from Oakwood, which is, I sort of built the program to be respectable, but in terms of levels, it was not the same level as a Mission Lake school.
Right.
And one of the questions that they pressed me on is, how are you gonna, coming from Oakwood, how are you gonna essentially attract players that are going to be able to compete against the Harvard Westlakes and the Crespies, and et cetera. And I said, my whole life, I basically, sort of live by a mantra. It's like a field of dreams sort of paradigm where, if I build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. So if I am who I am and I put my heart into something, I build it, it's going to attract people that want to be a part of it. Going back to Coach Harris, that's what I felt when I went and visited him. And I remember very, very vividly, there was a spring league game. They hosted a spring league. And I walked in the gym, and then talked to him, and he's like, why don't you go play? And back then, the spring league was coached by a dad who did the summer. It was not very, very informal. And I was like, basketball, I love to play. And he just called two kids over who had been, starters the previous year. He's like, go get Matt a jersey. And they were welcoming and open to me being there, and it was automatic. And I think, ultimately, I want to accept any kid or family that wants to be a part of what we're building. And, some people can make that decision and have the things line up for them, and they can make the decision going into freshman year. Some people might not figure it out to their sophomore year. Some people might have to figure it out to their senior year. But I'm not in the business of discriminating against any family or kid that wants to be a part of what Notre Dame as a school has to offer and what our program has to offer. And the second part of it is, I was lucky enough to go to Princeton, play at Princeton, and then work in what you would call the non-basketball real world for a number of years. And I was always taught from my youth coach and Coach Harris that basketball was supposed to be a way for you to learn life lessons and specifically to prepare you for life beyond basketball. And you can feel free to put in the comments, someone give me an environment in the real world where you will never have to deal with someone else coming in trying to be good at the very job that you're trying to go for or job that you're trying to get for yourself. That is a natural process of competitive environments. Yeah. And so, I think if we're going to actually prepare kids for the real world, that's a part of the real world. I was a kid that was coming into Ocean View. I'm sure there were players, actually I know there were players that thought that if I had not come, they would have got more playing time. Well, I wanted something different. My family moved. Coach Harris didn't reach out to me. I don't reach out to any of the kids that wanted to come transfer us. They want to come.
Right.
And so I explained to them, this is what it is. You want to be here, great. And then there's a competition. And so, at no time when I was at Ocean View, when I was taking people's minutes, was there any animosity? Because Coach Harris had built a program where we're all a family, we're also all competing.
Yeah.
And whoever's the better player is going to play, and we're going to support each other. And he did a good job of making everyone feel valued. I tried to do the same. But yeah, I just, this idea about, there's a right way for a program to be built, or there is this sort of old school notion of, you're disrespecting a player that's been in your program. And it's like, no, I'm my job is to prepare young men for life. And creating an environment that protects them from competition and discriminates against other kids that want to be a part of something that we're building, how does that prepare them for anything? That doesn't make sense to me. It's not how I was a transfer. It's not how my high school coach did it. And it's not how I'll ever do it. And I've always been that way. I took transfers at Oakwood. This is not like I'm at Notre Dame, I'm taking transfers.
Right, right.
We took a transfer from Campbell Hall, took a transfer from Windward. So this is, my thing is, if you want to come be a part of this, be a part of it. And similarly, if you don't want to be a part of this anymore, then I respect that too. There's a phenomenal success story to this where I'm really honest with my players, to a point where some people get, parents and players get uncomfortable with it, but I sort of lay out the continuum experience for a kid, based upon kind of where they are on the roster. So what that means is every spring or summer, I'm having conversations with players about you might not play. I'm not saying it's a guarantee, but you might not play. Yeah. And I tell them that because I want them to be able to make a decision. Or would you be comfortable here not playing and still being a supportive member of our family? And I'll give three examples. So one kid heard that message and decided, I was giving four examples. One kid heard that message and decided, I want to be a part of this team no matter what. And ended up, I sort of predicted, not playing. He was a great teammate. One kid heard that message and said, now I want to be a part of the program, and I trust myself, I'm going to prove you wrong. And that kid actually worked his way into the rotation. Right? I had another kid hear that message and say, you know what, like, going to my senior year, I kind of want to focus on my academics. I don't want to have basketball take time away if I'm not going to play. Left the team and did well as academics, kind of to a good school. And then the fourth kid heard that message and no parent meeting, nothing. They just transferred. And he ended up going to a school where they won a state championship. And he played and started his last 2 years of high school. Hmm. To me, all of those are success stories in their own right. Because it's each kid being given the opportunity to decide, what is it that I really want to do? What is it I want to focus my time on? What is the kind of experience I want to have? And all those kids know, like, we're at Notre Dame, there's possibly we're going to accept transfers. That's who I am. That's how I operate a program. Right. I'm not lying about it.
Right. Yeah. No, thank you. Yeah. I love the clarity of that. It's probably the most well thought out and verbalized way of with this transfer stuff, because I think I'm a fan of it. I mean, I've seen kids' lives change at Heritage because they came in, like, down to their academic transcripts were messed up and they couldn't even get into college if someone wasn't paying attention to it, because they weren't doing it at the previous school, not even on a basketball level. And also kids leaving Heritage and thriving at the next level, or not thriving, or whatever it is. Like you said, it's to each its own. And I think that as long as you're honest as a coach about what the expectation is, and it's a ongoing conversation, it's not a one-time conversation, because you never know how a kid's going to develop. Then who cares? It's going to lead them to somewhere, right? It puts them through an experience. And so,
So that's been, I think that's been sort of the thing that is, I've noticed out in the ecosystem, is just, it's a weird thing to have an aversion to, because I know the stats well enough to know, I don't think anyone knows this, but like 39% of college students, not student athletes, students, will transfer.
This is not talking like junior college, it's talking about university level.
University.
Wow.
39%. It's very difficult to like make the right decision at 18 for where you want to go to college. And so now we're going to penalize people because they didn't make the right decision for them when they were 14, 15.
Right.
That's a very weird way to think about it. And then a coach is supposed to, if the family applies, if they understand the vision of the school, the mission of the school, if they, you know, take the, you know, what the coach is describing as the program opportunity, to take that to heart, we're supposed to say no to them as a sophomore because they didn't know it was an eighth grader. I just, like, it doesn't really map on to reality for me.
Even when you get older and jobs, people leave jobs all the time.
This is the point. I just know of no other environment where people have this sort of feeling about. Now here, what I will address is, like, is it unfair to the kid that came in as a freshman, stayed in the program, thought he was gonna have a role as a senior, and is now not, because the kid that's coming in as a junior is taking that role? Yeah, of course it's unfair. Again, that is looking at a very short timeline, because either the point of basketball is just to win games and to like get what you feel you're privileged to get, or it's developing the kinds of skills and the kind of personality and intangibles that's gonna make you successful throughout life.
Yeah.
So I could expand this out. That kid that responded to that instance well, still worked hard in practice, found a way to carve out whatever role was for him, is gonna be better off when they go into the real world, where that might happen again. They thought they were gonna get a promotion and someone else applied from another company and they got it. Well, what are they gonna do? Are they gonna work really hard to show that they should have gotten it and then find a new role? Or are they gonna say, hey, you know what? Like, I'm gonna go to another company, I might appreciate you more, and I'll have what I like. These are all things that we want to be encouraging young men to be honest with and think about. And so it's weird that we want to create this world that doesn't actually mirror anything else that's happening in the real world. I don't get it. So I think most coaches at this point are open to it.
Yeah.
At this point, I think the view of it has sort of gone away, but I've been hearing the rhetoric for so long. It just never made any sense to me.
Yeah.
And I've been lucky enough in my my program that we've had kids stay for the most part.
Yeah.
And want to be a part of something. We very had rarely kids leave, even as we ask kids come in. And I think like that is a testament to one, the character of the kids, and to the overall feeling of the program.
Right. No, it's the culture. Like you said, you're creating the program. And I think
I don't want to give myself, the players have as much to do with the culture as
for sure.
I mean, I can only sort of set up systems, but the hard work and the buy-in of the players.
Everything rises and falls on leadership, though, and we know that, right? So there is something to say about you that, you know, these kids and the level of kid that you've had come through, right, and stay those 4 years and achieve their goals and see their dreams come true and playing college basketball, right? You being able to do it yourself, you know, yeah. And we'll get into that. So playing high school, recruitment for college.
Yeah.
You choose Princeton of all places. No, that's amazing. So how was your recruitment? Why did you choose Ivy League? And what was that experience like?
My recruitment was, it was interesting. You know, the first two offers I got were Long Beach State and UC Riverside. And after that, I really got hit hard by the Ivy League schools. And it was the Ivy Leagues, it was Stanford and Northwestern. And a really interesting thing happened. I remember I gave a hoop scoop interview. Clark Francis, I don't even know if he's still doing it. After the first Pangos camp, where he asked, this is the first time someone asked me if like the list of schools that are recruiting me. And I, you know, sort of listed the Stanford, Northwestern, the Ivies. And, you know, I didn't mention like the Pepperdines, the Urbines, whatever. And because there were a bunch of those schools that were recruiting me. And the moment that I said Ivy and Stanford, basically every other school just dropped off the face of the earth. I have some theories about this, but I think overall, like if you're, and this is probably back then, it was still true today with NIL and whatever, but back then it was sort of, my guess was if you're UC Riverside competing against Princeton and Penn is like a really hard sell.
Yeah.
Because at those times, those were better basketball programs. So by the time I got to like, you know, fall of my senior year, it was just the Ivy League schools, and that was it.
Wow.
No schools were even like contacting me. So I visited Santa Barbara. So I should say that. I did visit Santa Barbara on an official. And then for the recruitment part, it was, I hate to say it, and I try to talk as many kids out of it as I possibly can, but I simply just went to the school that had the best team.
Okay.
That's it. Yeah. At the time, of all schools that were recruiting me, going into my freshman year in college, Princeton was the highest ranked. We were ranked 31 in the country because they were returning half their starters on a team that made the tournament the year before. And so that's the best
that
team. I want to make the tournament. And they were losing a couple guards. I thought there was opportunity for me to start, which I ended up starting my freshman year. So there was opportunity. They were the best team. And academically, the difference between Princeton, Penn, and Yale is like just, it's a toss up.
Depending on the department or professor or whatever.
It wasn't moving the needle at that point. So yeah, just I picked the best team.
Nice. And then so you played as a freshman going into college.
Yeah, just came off the bench my first five games, started the next nine, then got hurt. And then stayed hurt for a couple of years.
What kind of injury did you have? Excuse me.
Well, it was misdiagnosed. Eventually, it was what I got surgery on was what's called a double sports hernia. I had two small tears in my lower abdomen, one here.
Wow.
Yeah, not fun.
Man, not at all. That impacts your whole body, I'm sure.
Yes. No, it was a very funky injury where you're in pain, but not so much pain that you can't play.
Right.
But you're nowhere near able to do any of the things athletically that you can do. So even if the pain on a scale of 1 to 10 is a 3, your capability on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the highest, is like a 1.
That's like 2K when you have minus, when you have an injury on the game. So on 2K, if you have a minor injury in the game, they'll like give you -9 rating. You could still play.
Yeah.
You'll just be playing on a bone knee.
There it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And so that happened your freshman year?
End of my freshman year, like going to league play. So I didn't play league play. My last game I ever started was at Duke. The last game I ever started.
Oh, man.
And then, yeah, I didn't play the whole league. And then came back sophomore year. Was first off the bench, first like 3 or 4 games. Felt the pain again, this time on the other side. Where it was on one side, now it's on the other side. It was basically in and out of practice the entire season. So I was out of the lineup completely. Had surgery. Came back my junior year, wasn't really fully healthy until about midway through junior year, but that year our starting backcourt were two freshmen that led the NCAA in minutes. So there was just
nowhere to crack it. Yeah.
Senior year we got a new coach, I was back to being first off the bench again, and then by end of my senior year we were, I don't know, like, I think we finished the season 6-23, so by the time we got into league play, I didn't play very much.
Man, but you got the Princeton education.
I did. Yeah, I did. I made good friends.
You fought through injury? when...
But yes. Yeah, I think like going through that adversity. I mean, really with that, my college experience, what I like to tell my players is that I've had every role that you could possibly have on a basketball team. In my career, right? Mm-hmm. I've had to be the guy that had to, if I didn't average 20 plus, we were going to lose. I've been the first off the bench. We're like, there's a certain way you got to play first off the bench.
Yep.
I've been 3-4 down the bench. I've been not playing at all and having to do scout. Like, I've literally done everything. And what I'll tell everyone on the podcast right now is that every single role is incredibly difficult. It's really hard. It is really hard to practice as hard as you have to on the scout team every day and then go sit on the bench and clap and be energized while your team's not doing well. It's a very hard thing to do. It is incredibly hard to be third or fourth at the bench where you will have the shortest leash because you're the eighth or ninth guy and you make one mistake and you're out. It is incredibly hard to be sixth man where like you kind of feel like you should be starting and you're being asked to do a starter's role, but like you're not. And so you're measured up to their sort of their metrics, but like you're not getting the same kind of time. So if you don't produce in that way, you're coming out. It's incredibly hard to be a role player on, you know, the starting lineup where like you're not in a role you think you should be in, but you've got to sacrifice for the team. If you're not doing those things, you're coming out. And then it's really hard to score 20 points a game.
It's hard.
All of those things are difficult, and you're supposed to be a star in your role. And so I think it's helped me as a coach that from high school through college, I really got to experience every single role you could possibly have on a team. And I appreciate how hard all of those things are.
No, that's amazing. And I, man, once again, the way you explain, you need to have the mind of Matt. You need your own podcast or book or something, man. It's the way you verbalize those things and for a level of understanding for kids that are going through it, right? And even the mental toughness that you had to have to, you know, go through that. You
and
talked about
that,
it before.
By the way.
Huh?
I failed at it, by the way. I tell this people all the time. I didn't handle it well.
Yeah, so yeah, that's what so I was like, going to ask you. So how? What was your mental... You know, you're on a scale of 1 to 10, how was your mental state during, you know, throughout your college career?
It flowed. You know, I think I didn't handle the first injury very well because the first time I'd ever been hurt. So I didn't handle that well at all.
Yeah.
I didn't lean into my teammates. I dissociated myself. I dissociated myself from the team in general because I didn't know how to handle not playing. It's the first time I'd ever not played my entire life. Mm. So I didn't handle that well. I think I handled the intermediate portion better. I rehabbed really hard. I tried to connect with teammates. I was active as a teammate. I got better at that. And then my senior year when I wasn't playing, I don't think I handled that well at all either because it was, you know, it was the end of my career and I'm not playing and we're losing.
Yeah.
You know, so I think all my college coaches probably agree that I didn't handle the first or end part well. But ultimately not handling it well and being able to look back on it and see how I didn't handle it well, I'm able to empathize a little bit better than I would have otherwise with my current and former players that are going through similar experiences. Because, you know, it's really hard coaching a kid that's injured. And it's really hard reintegrating a kid that's been hurt back into the fold. But I think, like, of my critiquing of myself, like, that's definitely, like, the top of the list of things I have a really hard time with is making the person that's hurt feel they're still in it. And then finding a way to get that person back into the fold so they feel like they were before they got hurt. I need to get way better at that.
Yeah.
And not that I blame my college coaches for my poor mental toughness, but like they also weren't very good at it. You know what I mean? Like,
I think it's tough for anybody.
Yeah, it's tough for anyone. So and to be fair to my college coaches, I was basically hurt for 2 years straight. So there was no incentive to be, you know, getting on the side of Matt, getting back into it because Matt may never get back into it. So I'm charitable to them in that sense. But yeah, I think I handled it as well as I could have because we always handle things almost as well as we could have given what we have at the time. But looking back on it, there's a lot of lessons that I learned from how I handled it that I try to impart on future generations of kids going through the same things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks for your transparency and understanding that and dealing with injury. So you became a coach.
Yeah.
How did that happen? So you said you went to the corporate world for a little bit. Yep. Was that immediately after graduating? Or?
Yes.
And so what was your experience like in the corporate world and what called you back to coaching?
Yeah, my college career is pretty tumultuous. So that's why when I tell people about the pro thing, I was offered a couple pro opportunities I turned down. I just like, I couldn't see myself going through anything similar to what I just went through and be 6,000 miles away from home. It didn't seem, I couldn't handle it at the time. So went to the startup, during my cousin's startup, that startup got bought by another company. Company then hired myself, my cousin, and their employee for our startup. Worked with them for like 4 years. And I basically had been I didn't touch a basketball for like 2.5 years.
Wow.
Did not touch a ball. Not to anything. I got really into barefoot beach running. I got into just running in general. I was working. I was reading like 100 books a day. I was just getting into other stuff that had nothing to do with hoop. And then I kind of got the itch again. So I was, at the time I was living about less than a mile from my high school gym. So I was seeing my high school coach pretty regularly anyway, but I just started watching the gym and I was just like, hey, I think I kind of want to get back into hoop. And so he like let me use the gym to train. And so basically I reached out to a friend of mine who was still kind of in the pro realm playing. And he let me know about this camp that he was going to. I don't know if they do this anymore, but it was a really interesting camp where it kind of functions similar to like a Pangos camp, right? We have all these players who are trying to play professionally in a gym, in a camp setting. All the agents are watching.
Oh, they still do them.
Yeah, all agents are watching. And then they live broadcast it for any professional team across the world to watch. And so I basically trained myself for basketball for like 3 weeks. I was already in great shape. I was running like 150 miles a month. So I was in.
Oh, you're running. Oh, yeah, goodness. On the beach, on the top of that.
On the beach, yeah. I was easily running 8 miles, no problem. So I was in phenomenal shape. And the skinny, I was 12 pounds below my playing weight, but I was in phenomenal shape. And so after 3 weeks of just like in ball in my hands again, shooting, did the camp, led the camp in assists, had two agents work with me. I got one job offer in Mexico, which I turned down because I basically got told that they don't pay you there. I didn't want to take that chance to quit my job to go somewhere where I might get the money. Got a tryout with the Lakers, what was called D-League back then.
The Defenders.
Yeah. Who was coached by Eric Musselman, who's now with the Trojans, who just offered my point guard. They basically whittled down like the camp to like top 30, top 20, top 10. I got to the top 20 and then they said they wanted me to take three guys. I got cut. And at that point, I was like, I think I feel assured that I was good enough to do it. And if life didn't work out that way, maybe I'd get hurt, but I feel I could compete. So I'd scratch that itch. So I go back to my high school coach. I'm like, I want to stay in basketball, but I don't think playing's it for me. So I kind of start coaching with you. And he's like, I think the best thing for you to do is start working at the youth level first. I don't want you working with me quite yet. So he put me in touch with this guy who had like a couple of like 10 to 11 year old teams. And so I started working with him. And that is when I met my current best friend, Shay Frazee, who's...
Wait, you and Shay are besties?
Yeah, it's like...
Did he tell us this? This is great. I just had Shay on the podcast.
Oh, like, did you?
He was the last person on the podcast. Oh, and he was talking about people, but he did not mention you, which is wild.
We talk every day. I send all my guys to go train with him. He was my wedding party.
Check out his episode. It just posted on Monday.
I'm sure my mom will send it to me.
There you go.
So I met Shay, and the legend of our friendship goes. Just quick thing. I never lose one-on-one. The entire time I was playing basketball, I don't lose one-on-one games. And so Shay comes to do a ball handling workout with this club program that I was working for. And watching him do the ball handling, I'm like, oh, this guy's pretty good. So we start chopping up about whatever. And practice is over. I'm like, hey, man, you want to play ones? And he proceeds to just kick my butt. Just absolutely dominate me. And that's when I was like, you're my best friend now. What are you doing? Where are you playing? I wanna play. I wanna be wherever you're at. So I started training with him and another guy named Charlie Torres at the American Sports Center. 3 weeks into that training, I met a family whose daughter was gonna be an incoming freshman at Los Alamitos. The mom took a liking to me. She said, hey, we don't have a coach for the varsity team. You should apply. And I was like, I haven't coached anywhere. But sure, applied, got the job.
Wow.
And that's kind of what kicked me off into my coaching career.
Wow. Just being around the game. I love basketball, man. The paths it takes you. So you started off as a girls coach.
Yep.
And then where did you go from there?
Yeah, we had a really successful year. My first year, I was lucky, as I'll always say, to have really good players. That freshman ended up playing at, I believe, Western Washington. And then we had another freshman that year who ended up playing in the WNBA.
Oh, wow.
So we were really good. And right or wrong, and I don't know if this is true, so you know, don't get mad at me for saying this, but I reached out to a couple of my friends that were ADs, and they basically said, if you coach girls basketball for more than 2 years, you get labeled a girls coach, and it's very hard to get a boys job.
Yeah.
I find that very silly. But if that is true, and I took that to heart, I started looking for boys jobs. And so Oakwood had let go of their coach really late. So I actually took, this is the hardest thing I ever did. I took the Oakwood job in October and had to leave Los Alamitos basically right before the season.
Oof.
And it was, that was like one of the hardest team meetings I've ever had. I was telling the girls that I was leaving. Now, in my mind, my cognitive dissonance and my, to sort of rationalize the move was that I convinced my youth coach, the coach was from 6 to 13, to take over for me at Los Alamitos. So I felt like I knew they'd be in good hands.
You just didn't leave them like
I
empty.
Knew
the
same messaging, the same, basically the same practice structure.
Gotcha.
You know, they didn't take a liking to them as much as myself because there's a difference between, you know, 27-year-old and a, you know, 65-year-old.
Right.
So, but from a basketball and like value standpoint, I didn't feel like I was leaving them in the lurch. But still, it was a very hard decision. So.
Yeah.
I go to Oakwood and then spend 4 years there. Again, very lucky. I came in with a young man named Matt Martinez, who's actually was on my staff last year at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Who's now going to go be a GA at Duke. And you know, I had all 4 years with
him. Don't say that lightly. He's going to be a GA at Duke.
He'll be a GA in his second year in the program, but he's going to be a GA at Duke.
That's awesome.
And yeah, I coached him for all 4 years. And you know, when I wrote his letter of rec for Duke and for other places, I just say like he's the one that changed the culture of Oakwood basketball. He's the one. It was like it was him. It was like it couldn't be anyone but him. And I was able just to sort of like show him how to do it, how to get everyone in alignment, how to
bring
build
it together.
The community. But
that's
yeah,
awesome.
I was lucky.
That's awesome. And then Oakwood 4 years, and then Notre Dame opens up.
Yep. Yeah. And then that was really simple. I'd been training athletes the entire time I was coaching. So. Mm-hmm. And we're still maintaining my relationship with Shay while I was coaching. And so I developed a relationship with the Rishwanes. And so I was training Julian Rishwane while he was at Notre Dame.
Oh, okay.
And I was coaching at Oakwood. I was training him. And so when that job opened up, the dad was like, you should apply. I was like, okay, I'll apply. But again, like, I'm coming from Oakwood. We've won a league, but we haven't won a CF title. I don't know if I have the resume. And luckily, the Notre Dame felt I was the right person for the job. So I got the job there.
Man, sweet. I remember you working out Jack at 360.
Yeah.
At Bloomsdart. It's Joe, because he was over there. Joe's like, hey, can this guy train? Is he really what he says he is? I remember getting that call. I'm like, sure, I'll check him out. And I'm like, oh, yeah. No, he's the real deal.
Yeah.
He's the real deal. So.
Jack is a great kid. Yeah. He transferred before I got the job.
Right.
So it was phenomenal. I believe he's working at Maine now for the Nets.
Yes.
Great kid.
Awesome kid. Yeah. And your coaching or your tree, your player tree, you know, I don't know if you ever pay attention to that thing, but man, that's how I kind of judge coaches by that. Like, how many coaches have you developed and how many players are doing things with basketball still, or even anywhere in life, but I do judge it with basketball more so. And not when I say judgment, it always sounds negative to people in a good way. Evaluating, like, man, that's awesome that you had that much impact on a player for them to stay with basketball. And, that much impact on coaches that they're able to run their own program for what they ran, you know, when their time with you. And so, you know, it's always a good thing to see. And so your time at Notre Dame, you started off with pretty strong, or a lot of talent, right? And was Dusty's freshman year and Ben their freshman year, your first year or second year?
No, so I didn't get Ben till my second year.
Okay.
And then Dusty was the year
after. Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
Okay, and so, What did you do immediately? Stepping into the Mission League, it's high-level basketball. Yeah,
great coaches, a lot of talent. You know, I think the first, you know, it's fine. I'm looking back on it, we're good.
Yeah.
I think the first couple years, I kind of got away from myself. I think I got a little too obsessed with winning. I think I sort of missed out on the why I got into coaching in the first place, which was the sense of values and sort of teaching a way to look at basketball and a way to look at life. And I got way too into that, like, I have to prove myself. I have to show that I belong here. And, you know, I wasn't hard enough on my better players, and I just kind of lost all that. And so I remember when Ben's dad reached out to us about Notre Dame, and I met them, I'd already sort of kind of realized that were kind of like my first year mistakes. And I was like, listen, if he comes here, like, I'm gonna be hard on him. And I kind of set the tone for that for all my players I felt like had talent. And because I'm hard on all my guys, I'm coaching them difficult, but I'm especially hard on the ones that have to do the most. One, it prepares them for college. And two, you lose respect from your team if you're going your hardest on the guy who's like barely playing. So you have to show that you're holding the guys who do the most accountable. And so like that was my big adjustment. So first 2 years were rough. And then once Ben goes into sophomore year and Dusty comes in, and I basically, everyone in the program were like 80%, 85% are sort of my guys that chose to play for me, that got the messaging about the program initially from me. At that point, I was able to sort of like get the machine sort of running. Luckily was able to keep all my players that wanted to come play for me for the 4 years, able to attract some good players. And I always tell people, like, the players are the ones that are your biggest advocates for coming to a program.
Yeah.
Right? With the lone exception of Mercy and Caleb, who literally just showed up out of nowhere, anyone else that wanted to come, it was because when they talked to Ben, they talked to Dusty, when they talked to Kendall or Dante, like, they have good things to say about the program and specifically the school. Like, Notre Dame is in like prime position, 101, 405 interchange, like, right. In LA, like, it's a big school with diversity, and it's a great community campus, good academics, it's like, it's a great school too. But the players are the biggest advocate. And so I felt like once Ben and Dusty and Luke Richwain, Julian's brother, and Dante, Ogbu, once, and Kendall Haley, like, once all those guys sort of took over the program, that's when we really start to hit a whole other gear.
Yeah. Now you can even tell in the way they played how fast you guys became
and the buy-in
to you trusting them, right, to play that fast and make decisions and play a brand of basketball that some high school coaches are like, no, you have to run my plays every time type of thing. And I think it shows. I'm a fan of it because that's how I teach kids, is like, no, I want you to be a basketball player. I don't want to, like, plays are great for certain situations, but you need to learn how to play basketball, because especially in the Mission League, all your plays are they're gonna know your plays.
Yeah.
So you're gonna have to be able to respond and to, just hoop at the end of the day. And so I've always loved that, just about their style of play. And this, your press, I still don't get it. I gotta sit in on our practice or something. You turn people up really fast with that press. And I remember when Zaire was there.
I think like the Zaire experience was probably the most I've ever learned as a coach from one player, because he was a phenomenal kid, phenomenal talent, and I don't feel like I coached him very well.
Like, gotcha.
So I just don't think I did a very good job. I mean, obviously it didn't hurt him, he's doing fine,
right.
But I think we didn't play as fast as I wanted to with that group, and I think it's because I wasn't willing to push him more to play faster. And the reasons for that that are all on me, but like, that's why, again, when Ben, Dusty, and anyone else that comes in, there's always a conversation like, hey man, we're gonna play faster here. How fast we play is gonna be determined by a lot of factors, but ultimately, like, the underlying philosophy of this team is that we try to make decisions quickly, play quickly, and try to put teams in situations where, like, they're going to be moving outside of their comfort zone. You know, how we do that changes team.
Gotcha.
We didn't do that first 2 years. First 2 years, I was basically like half court team. We were averaging like 60 points per game, and it's just not wasn't being fitting to our roster. Wasn't being fitting to myself and my philosophy as a coach and a person. And I think it's just like I was too willing just to let Zaire be good and get 30 and 15, because he was, but that wasn't what was good for us.
Yeah.
You know, I was relying too much on just his talent. That's not fair to him, and it wasn't fair to us as a team. And so I kind of stopped doing that.
You know what I mean?
Like, it's, but that, again, that's the first time I ever coached anyone that good before. So
right,
why would I be good at coaching someone that good? So I've had players as good as him since then. I've done a much better job. Again, not perfect, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. 5 years from now, I'll look back on how I coached Caleb Mercy and feel like, there's some things I could have done better, but or even Dustin Bennett. But I learned a lot about like, what does it really mean to coach very elite players? It's a different
ball
game.
Yeah.
That I didn't have before.
No, I think that's important. I think people say, if I had the players, then I would. Oh, okay, go ahead and try it, do it. Yeah. And I think it's led you to where you are, back-to-back Division I state champs.
Well, state and section.
State and section.
One state and section.
My bad.
Be fair to St. John Bosco, who just won it this past
year. I apologize. State and section. What was different? What made you guys a, you know, title team, like internally?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it was three things. One, like the continuity of the program over the course of the 4 years, through Ben's 4 years, and then Ben left. So, and Dusty being like the person who was there pretty much the entire time. So they had the continuity of the program, which was cemented. And then I think, obviously, you know, you bring in someone comes Mercy and Caleb, it just elevates you to a whole other realm. I mean, Caleb, I don't think anyone, this is not like a, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not a hot take, but I think Caleb's one of the better offensive guards I've ever seen
at
this level. And yeah, I mean, people tell me I didn't see Drew Holiday play, but like that's a comp I hear from just pure offense. And then, you know, then you have Mercy, who's the most competitive player that I've ever coached. And then you have Dusty, who like in some ways is a high school cheat code just because of all the things Dusty can do on the floor. I mean, Dusty is capable of being option 1, 2, or 3. Equally well, which is a very hard thing to do. He's able to guard 1 through 5 equally well. So you have this like perfect, like unbelievably versatile basketball player, you know, highly competitive Mercy, and then this offensive wizard. And then at the same time, Dante and Lino easily could have left and transferred.
Yeah.
It would have been rational for them to do so. I would have been mad at them for doing so, but they're unselfish kids who understood, you know, wanting to be a part of something special, and so they stayed. So they don't stay like, we're not good. Like, we're nowhere near as good as we should be. And then the rest of the team is there's that continuity of the program. You know, I think, you know, Zach White being a freshman able to do the role that he had is also like, that came out of nowhere. We didn't expect that of Zach. But I think like, so it's those, right? It's the continuity of the program. It's obviously attracting good players, and it's the guys who stay even though their role is different now that guys have come in.
Yeah.
And I think those three things allowed us that year to sort of, you know, play the number one schedule in the country and still, you know, win at the level that we won. And then last year it was, you know, basically a lot more of the same where you had the continuity of the program, right? You have Mercy, who's Mercy's leap from junior to senior year is unlike anything I've ever seen before. You know, you could almost look back at knowing how good he is now, looking at his junior year, you could almost say that, you know, the unselfishness he had to really take a backseat the way that he did was impressive.
Yeah.
You know, we could look back and say that.
Everybody waited their turn. And that's what, like even Lino now, right? Getting the SC offer, like he had to see it, you know what I mean? Like to instill that vision into him, like, hey, you're going to get yours. Just like these three or four before you got theirs. And sacrificing a little bit of who you are for the big picture and still
it's going to help when he gets to college too, is that like for the most part, most people that go to college have that same process where they have to basically figure out who am I if I'm not the guy?
Yeah.
How do I make my way? You know? So, and then last year it was the continuity. You had, you know, Mercy and Lino, and then Zach sort of leading up to his role. And then, you know, I had a bunch of, five of our players in our rotation last year played JV the year before, at least 1 or 2 years, which is again a testament to that thing I was telling you about our program. Mm-hmm. You know, I have coaching friends that like over the years have just given me a hard time about the transfers thing. And so one recent conversation, the coach was praying to me like, you know, how many of your kids in your rotation like play JV? Like, aren't you just bringing in kids? So I was like, actually, that's a really good question. So I went back over it. In percentage-wise, in my rotation over the last like 4 year period, we've been really good. 65% of those kids have played at least 1 year of JV. And a testament to my JV coach, who's incredible, who as soon as he wants to be a head coach, varsity head coach, he will be one just whenever he wants it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so like I said, continuity program, really good players. And then again, you know, Bronson was a huge ad, and that just really came out of nowhere, you know.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he literally had a really hard senior year.
Yeah.
You know, where he got put in a situation first out of Oak Hill that wasn't very good, and he didn't know where he could be. So, you know, he talks to his parents are like, you know what, we need to find you a Catholic school. You went to Catholic school in New Zealand. These other schools you're going to, there's no values, they're not good environments, like find a Catholic school. And so they like, we are one of the, as of right now, like one of the preeminent Catholic programs in, yep, in the country. So he reaches out and then he just has what he has with his dad. Where we, like, we missed him for about a month of the season, him flying back to New Zealand to deal with the passing of his father.
Yeah.
You know, so just a really, but again, it, like even with that, just him being attracted to come, plus the continuity, plus Mercy, Lino, Zach sort of, you know, elevating their games is what will sort of help us.
You said it. That's the name of the show.
Oh, yeah.
So I appreciate it. No, but no, that's awesome, man. It's like you said, the you build it and they'll come.
Yeah.
And so being able to see it from that lens, right, just as a basketball person, right? And I don't think people understand that you're really not recruiting. Like, these people are literally showing up at your doors. Like, I know every story, like every single one of these stories I know is like, literally they just show up and they're, yeah, just there. And
you take phone calls. Don't get me wrong, I don't reject, right, phone calls, except for right now. but yeah, just the, like, it's, my wife is the one that laughs the most about me because she knows what a short leash I'm on. That once practice is over, I'm home. I'm with the kids. We have 3 kids under 5. So the idea that like I'm out there just in these gyms talking to parents, like, no, I'm really just,
right,
gym, my classroom, and at my house, and that's it, you know?
No, that's, okay, awesome, man. Thank you, man. I think your just basketball story, and you said 2 times on this, things that you've never shared before, maybe in your basketball journey, and so thank you for sharing those things, and I think it's beneficial to hear someone who's doing it for the right, for the love of the game, and producing athletes to reach their goals is always important. I'm a fan of that. Like, if you're here for these kids, that's what it's about. So appreciate all you do, all you've done, and all you're going to do. We're going to go through these next segments quick.
Let's do it.
All right, all right. Yep. My Rushmore. Okay. All right. Princeton guy. Everybody talks about the Princeton offense. Do,
sure,
you run, do you run the Princeton offense?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, just making sure. And so got to have some IQ, right? Yeah. 4 top IQ players ever.
Ever? Oh.
Or you want current? You
no,
know,
no, no, no.
You want current?
Ever's
fine?
More
all
interesting.
Right.
I mean, obviously, like, I'm going to have a bias just because of my age. So, like, I can't really speak on many older players.
Mm-hmm.
But I think on any list of high IQ players, like, probably have to put Larry Bird up there, right? Probably, you give me like a minute here.
So no, I'm good.
Cycling through names.
Yep.
But Bird for sure. I mean, I think LeBron has to be on this list.
Yes.
I don't know how he's not.
Yeah.
I can make a dig at his skill level, which is why Zach has to be so good, but I won't do that. I'm kidding. All LeBron fans. Yeah, so LeBron, Bird, I think Nash has to be on that. I don't know how you put him off. So let's go centers now, since I don't have one. And now we are in the either Walton or Jokic. And that's a toss-up. Rest in peace, Bill Walton. Let's go Bill Walton. Rest in peace.
I like it. So I have the same first three as you. My Nash, Bron, Bird.
Yeah.
My fourth is actually going to go to Rajon Rondo.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think
I was off point guards, so I went to a different.
You went to big, yeah.
Route. But yeah, no, the Rondo makes sense. Have you heard about his training where he tries to throw bounce passes through chairs? Have you
no.
Heard about this?
So I've been. That's why I'm
is
biased because I've been in his. Oh no, he
that's
is
a real thing.
He's a magician, man. The things that he can do with the basketball and the way he can manipulate somebody's body who's guarding him. Like he uses pressure points. He's literally taught us how to like grab somebody's thigh and like make their leg dead on a drive and like hit the angles he hits on the backboard on his finishes. And it, first off, you don't train Rajon Rondo. You put him through a workout. He trained you. Like he's the one teaching you. And so it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, Rondo 6 a.m. workouts, my favorite time of the day. It was a classroom for basketball.
That's awesome.
It was ridiculous. And so
no, that's a good one. Yeah, I think if I was doing it, if I didn't try to pivot to centers, I probably
wouldn't. Jokic is good, though. Jokic is up there for sure. And Walton.
Yeah, for sure. That's really interesting. I'll have to ask about some of the other stuff that Rondo taught you. I don't know about teaching kids about the screening of the legs.
It's simple. It's simple, and nobody sees it, so it works. But, Rondo's angles. He taught how to attack an angle and the passes you make and how you make them. And man, it's crazy.
He's in my class and we played against him. The big tournament back then was the big time in Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
We played against him. He was actually the second best guard on that team.
To?
Chris Lofton.
Oh.
Chris Lofton hit us for like 9 threes. We had no answer.
Bucket.
We had no answer for Chris Lofton. We were all worried about Rajon. Rajon was the higher ranked player.
Yeah.
And obviously ended up being the better basketball player. Yeah. But in that game, like, we had no answer.
He probably
answer for
hit
Chris
all
Lofton.
Those buckets because of Rondo, though, right? Finding him on those. No.
Man, my memory of it, I don't remember anyone passing the ball. He only had it. He was shooting it. He like passed it to himself. He was like, it was insane. Never seen anything like it. It was like a Steph performance before Steph was Steph.
Gotcha.
You know, it was crazy.
Yeah, no, you can hoop. Our next segment, fix the net. So your net's there. I'm gonna get this basketball for you. A misconception about Matt Sargent that you would like to make straight. If you can't think of any, you can do it just about basketball in general. Or do you want me to tell you about a misconception about you to help you?
Sure.
All right.
Yeah.
Word is,
okay,
and this is all due respect, but it's good. I wanted to make it straight that you're a transactional coach, that you don't care about the kids and you're tough on them and all you care about is winning. Which you've already stated in this.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a misconception. I spend most of our time doing stuff for team and personal character building. So that's definitely a misconception. I mean, if I put it this way, I've played for transactional coaches. I know what that looks like. I've had coaches that literally only address me if I was in between the lines. Mm. And when they address me, it's nothing to do with anything other than basketball and just my performance. I know what that looks like. That does occur, obviously, because you're trying to coach kids. But I think between our graduate sessions and our weekly team lunches and our team bonding and my just like my care and knowledge of our players, I would fix the net on that and say like the most important thing to me is that I have relationships with my players.
No, I wanted to do that for you because I know you. a lot of the kids that come from CORE, you know, go to Notre Dame, and it's, they value my opinion about where to go for high school, and I would not encourage them to go to a transactional coach.
In this day and age,
because the psychology of this generation is so different. They need someone who cares and who walks with them and has that relationship with them, and so I wanted to make that straight for you because I hear that a lot and I'm like, dude, that's not the case at all.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, like, listen, any amount of success you're going to have and with someone like myself, and there's their conception like I'm really hard on my players, and I am. So, like, that can easily be misinterpreted. But, yeah, I spend a lot of time.
That means you care more.
Oh, yeah.
That means you care more.
I spend a lot of time with my players addressing non-basketball things.
Yeah.
Everything from, we have talks about consent, we have talks about social media use, we have talks about drugs, alcohol, and the danger. We do spend a lot of time with each other in a group and then personally discussing things that have nothing to do with basketball. And I can assure you that transactional coaches, by definition, don't do that.
100%.
That's what's important to me, that they're good human beings.
Absolutely, 100%. And now, is there anything about basketball that you, like a... something in basketball that you're like, yeah, that's a misconception.
Yeah. This is going to be a little ironic because we set a state record for threes. but I would say at the high school and college, specifically the high school and college level, not the NBA, high school and college level, the three-point shot is massively overvalued.
Really?
Massively overvalued. The team that wins is the team that generates the most easy buckets. And for teams that win, they get 70 to 80% of the points in the paint, including free throws. Free throws is a paint shot.
Right.
Three-pointers are massively overvalued at high school and college level. Players don't shoot them well enough. They're not professionals like the NBA players. And I think like that's the one thing that I've had to learn over the last 4 years and the big thing that's funny. people's perceptions get so locked in. So we had that year we shot 43s because that team had to. We had no one that could really generate layups.
Hmm.
We didn't have any bigs.
Right.
We had 8 shooters. So what do? You shoot a lot of threes. So I remember, I won't name the person, but in the last 2 years, we specifically have like focused on shooting less threes. So that team that set the state record, we shot 38 threes a game.
Dang.
Last year's team that won CIF shot 17 threes, made 5 a game.
Wow.
And still averaged in the mid 70s because of the pace of play.
Right.
Done different. Yeah. But I had someone that I won't name before our CIF championship game against Windward come up to me and be like, "So this game's gonna come down to 3-pointers, right? Whoever makes the most threes." And I was like, "Have you watched us play this year?" I was like, "Yeah, you shoot a lot of threes." I was like, "No, we don't shoot hardly any threes. We're averaging 24 free throw attempts a game.
Wow.
We're to the cup. Like, we're trying to get layups, and the team that gets the most layups is the team that's gonna win this game." So yes, I think that's the biggest misconception is that, again, you're gonna have some teams that have like a lot of shooters, and that's great, but just generally speaking, points in the paint at this level is what decides winning more than volume of 3-point shooters.
I love that. I'm adding that to my and one. All right, no, I love that. I'm adding that to my coaching philosophy because there's a lot of defensive schemes now to run people off the 3-point line. Maybe you don't have to as much.
Well, I think like it's a mixture, right? I mean, any team you're playing, there's going to be a scout where some guys you run off the line.
Of course.
Some guys you're disrespecting, and we. You know, when we practice, we emphasize, like, do not give up layups. And right now what we're really bad at is we're fouling people on shot attempts. So as that important, like, don't give up free throws either, right? So, but it's just if we can force that team to shoot more contested threes, specifically because we want shooting threes, and we are on the other end generating layups and free throws and all of our 15 to 17 threes are quality, like, we're going to have a better chance to win. Then
makes sense.
Energy. Yeah.
Love that. Cool. I don't know if you should have told that. We're gonna cut this out so coaches don't take his idea. No.
If people watch us play, it's very
you
obvious.
You know, right?
Yeah, like it's not a secret.
No, it's beautiful. All right, we flipped the script. You're the interviewer now. 2 questions for me. Could be about anything in the world.
Okay, this is you music guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
A little bit.
I'm gonna give you an opportunity to create a 3-day music festival. You get a headliner and a sub-headliner for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Okay.
It can be any era, and you get the band in whatever era you want to get them in. So let's say I want Michael in 84 to headline Sunday. What is your Friday, Saturday, and Sunday lineup?
Beautiful. Okay, so Friday, I'm going to start with a West Coast Friday. DJ Quick's going to be my headliner.
Headliner or sub-headliner?
Headliner,
okay.
That's DJ Quick for me. My sub-headliner will be The Game.
Okay, so The Game
is DJ Quick. It'll be a West Coast Friday. Yep, just to get the party started, get everything going. And this is DJ Quick. This is late 90s, early 2000s DJ Quick.
Yep.
And this is the prime game.
It's like mid-2000s.
Yeah, 2000s, yep. Documentary, Doctor's Advocate, The Game. My Saturday, I'm gonna go with, I'm gonna headline with Drake.
Okay.
Regardless of recent stuff. I'm gonna go with Drake, and the sub headliner is actually gonna be Janae Aiko.
Okay.
I'm a fan of Janae Aiko, even though I shouldn't be listening to her, somebody told me. I don't know. Anyway.
So Janae.
Yeah, Janae. Drake and Janae, because I think vibes, like, you know, you have your vibes Saturday. And then Sunday, I'm gonna go, this is a good one. I'm gonna headline with Maverick City Music.
Okay.
On the worship side. And then my sub headliner would be Andy Mineo, who's a Christian rapper.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, so my Sunday would be a more spiritual day. That's actually what I listen to more than all that other stuff, is more worship music than anything.
Very cool.
So it'd be a more of a worship Sunday. So
it sounds like a fun festival.
Yeah, it's cool. It's for me. I don't know who else is coming, but
other fans of the music.
Yeah. I love it. That's a cool question. I like that.
Second question. Movies. Let's do movies. Aliens have come. They say you have to show us one movie, and if we don't like it, we're eradicating your species. We have to like it. Which movie do you show them?
Oh, you know nothing about man. Them. I know nothing now, about
this is,
them.
This is, well, the reason I love this question is like, you have to think of a movie that's like universally likable. It can't yes. be like your pick. Some people like movies that like, it's their
right.
movies, right?
So right.
what is a movie that you like, but also that you are comfortable that
everybody's
an alien
still
race
like,
is going to be on board? Otherwise, man. The whole, otherwise yeah, humanity's
My
done.
First movie would have got us all killed.
Yeah.
For sure. I got to think of the second one. We would have been done. My wife doesn't like movies that I like, so I'm trying to find something that we both like.
There you go.
That's the first key. And I want them to laugh so they could be in good spirits. So
laughing
have,
stuff, because humor across generations is,
breaks everything.
Yep. So it's,
and I'm almost want to do something where there's aliens in the movie, but then that's, they might feel disrespected. So I think I'm gonna go with The Hangover.
The Hangover?
I think I'm going with The Hangover.
People in the comments, you have to vote on, did we survive?
Did we survive? Funny movie, man. I think it is generationally funny. I think you have a little bit of everything. And no, we're dead, Karina? Karina is shaking her head, we're dead. Oh, man. Karina, what would you pick?
The
Bee
Movie.
The Bee Movie? I've never even seen it.
What?
Yeah, we're dead. Thanks, Karina. We just
I mean, it could be phenomenal. I don't know. I haven't seen it. Oh, the Bee Movie.
Yeah, Bee Movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's a movie, but it's related to life, and it's actually inspiring.
Going the animated.
You think aliens care about our life?
Going the animated route is interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't think
I would have went before. Shrek if I was going to animation.
Yeah, there you go.
I would have went Shrek.
Yeah.
What do you got?
Oh, I'm choosing Before Sunrise.
I don't even know what that is.
Exactly. 100% Rotten Tomatoes. Well. It's about two people that meet on a train in Vienna. Spend a day together, and you actually watch them fall in love in the most authentic way you could possibly imagine. So the aliens are like, it's basically going to show them humanity. So if they want to kill us after that, we were going to be dead no matter what.
I love it. My first movie was Dope, which is We Want to Survive. Like, what is this? What is this? Oh, man. Thank you, man. Yeah. Awesome questions. You have a 24-second shot clock. That's your camera there. Let the people know where they can find you on social media and any message that you
don't
have.
I don't have any social media, but please come watch us play and support the basketball, support our boys. They work really hard. Hopefully we'll have another good season, and we appreciate any community that comes to support the Notre Dame program.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Thank
That's you. All we got for you guys today. We'll see you next time. Peace.